Hello and welcome to Unofficial Partner, the sports business podcast. I'm Richard Gillis. This is the first in a new series looking at the business of esports in collaboration with Nielsen Sports, the world's leading source of sports measurement and analytics. Today's guests are Matthew Archambault, Head of Partnerships for North America at Riot Games, publishers of the phenomenally successful League of Legends franchise. Matt manages strategic partnerships, national sponsorships, media rights, and merchandising for the League Championship Series. Joining Matthew is Matt Boyd, Vice President of Nielsen Esports and Games, based in North America. Matt leads client relationships with teams, publishers, leagues, and brands, providing the data analysis to help them maximize the value of their commercial partnerships. So, this is a conversation unpicking how the business of esports works through the lens of the industry's multiple stakeholders, from the game publishers to the media platforms and the commercial partners, through to the teams, leagues, players and fans. To keep in touch with the rest of the series, make sure you subscribe to Unofficial Partner via Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or via your favourite podcast app. If you like the pods, you'll love the Unofficial Partner newsletter that goes direct to the inbox of thousands of senior executives across the global sports business every Thursday. To join them, sign up via unofficialpartner.com.
You could build a podcast empire in 7 days, mate.
That's what I'm going for. It's my coming out party. It's empire today.
Yeah. Come in. The water's lovely. Come in.
That's great.
Right. Well, to start off, we've got an obvious confusion that whenever you two appear on a panel, we've both got the same name. So Matt Boyd from Nielsen. Let's call you Nielsen, Matt. And Matt Archambault. Is it Archambault? Is that a bit of a, is that a flourish that I've added there?
It's a little bit. It is technically French, so it's Archambault, but most people end up just calling me Arch or Matt A because it's a mouthful otherwise.
Matt A or Riot Matt.
Riot Matt was completely fine.
Riot Matt could be a brand. You're working on the brand there. Just to get us going, because this is the first in a series that we're going to be talking about esports, and we're going to cover lots of different bases, and you very kindly both volunteered to be on the first one because we want a broad look at the landscape, and we're going to cover quite a few different areas over the next sort of 45 minutes or so. But I'm going to start off just to position you. I'm going to ask very simply what your job is. So Nielsen, Matt, what is it? What do you do? What gets you up in the morning?
Yeah. So I am the VP and head of esports and games for Nielsen Sport. I now sit across both of those businesses and kind of lead all aspects of those businesses. So obviously I have a commercial focus on that, on both of those kind of verticals, but, you know, also spend a fair amount of time kind of helping out with project management and thinking of kind of the sort of broader strategy for not only our business as it relates to esports and games, but naturally the esports and games sectors as a whole. So I'm actually relatively new to this role, not so new to working in esports. You know, I joined Nielsen Sports back in 2015 and sat on our consulting practice for about 5 years. And a lot of my time down the stretch on the consulting team was thinking about esports and how we kind of grew our esports business, but naturally that also meant how do we sort of help the esports industry grow as a whole. And that's where I got some of my first exposure to Riot Matt. We had a few projects going on with Riot around that time, and also Riot kind of was participating alongside us quite a bit in kind of thinking about the broader space and how do we standardize metrics? How do we standardize the conversation? What does the industry need? How do we all kind of grow the pie here? So yeah, and that was fun work. And that's why I've now kind of doubled down and kind of when Nielsen asked me to step into this role, I was all for it. So that's a very, very quick little history. Yeah.
Okay. Right. That sets us up nicely. Riot, Matt, same question to you. What is he? What do you do all day?
It's a good question. So I would say I do a little bit of everything. So my role is effectively, I lead partnerships and business development for Riot in North America and Oceania. So what that really means in practice is we focus a lot on what's going on in esports. So all of the monetization, distribution, licensing that has to do with our leagues. You know, we operate regional leagues. So whether that's League of Legends or Valorant, Wild Rift, TFT, Legends of Runeterra. We have now multiple titles, which is pretty exciting. We put the S in games. So we do manage that. And then we work with our publishing team, you know, in terms of like co-op marketing, things along those lines. So in a way, I like to say that our team kind of is the glue that holds the regions together, or it's the sand in between the larger pebbles that are the creative geniuses at the rest of the company, but have definitely been involved in and everything that we try to do that has like business implications. And that obviously involves getting into the space from data and analytics and measurement. And I think, you know, if I go back to my background, I've been at Riot now for 3 years. Wow, feels like a decade, 3 years. I did not come as an endemic gamer, so to speak. I actually came from the media agency and kind of marketing perspective before this. I've always played video games my whole life, back when my parents told me I should stop. And now I get to work across of both sports, which I absolutely love, and gaming, which I also love. And so it's a happy marriage. And that's what keeps us going all day, every day, because it's basically a 24/7 job.
So esports years are a bit like dog years, are they? They just there's a different thing going on.
They are. Although I'd almost say that you can put that sprint into like a month. A month is like a year in many ways.
Yeah.
Just because of the amount of just opportunity and just activity that's going on. There's really never a dull day.
So let's just continue that. Riot, how does it make money? What's the business model?
Yeah, it's a good question. So at our core, Riot is a game publisher. And all of our titles are global in nature, and they're all free-to-play games. And so Riot was one of the first publishers that came out with this free-to-play model a number of years ago, and we launched League of Legends. I think the mentality in the market at the time was, well, that's crazy. You're never going to do anything. You need to, you know, charge $50, $60, whatever it is, plus subscriptions. And so really for Riot, the mentality was, you want to be fully inclusive. Our games are all open. There is no competitive advantage you can get by buying a thing. You can't come in and say, oh, I'm going to spend, you know, $100. And then, you know, Nielsen, Matt says, I'll spend $1,000 and he's better. It all really comes down to playing and everything, but it's a microtransaction. So it's buying characters, it's buying agents, buying champions, buying skins, aesthetics, things that, you know, make you feel kind of part of the community. But that's effectively our core business model, like from the game side of it. But then as a result of that, getting into esports in particular, if you look way back, like I think esports is really unique in just the sport world, because the community is really what drove towards esports, right? It wasn't just publishers sitting back saying like, all right, there's 40 of us. Let's just put our game online and hopefully people are going to watch it. Like at the time when we first had our first worlds, we thought maybe 30 people would watch, maybe 100, right? There were millions, right? So it was kind of crazy. But the community really drives that forward, and that's now turned into its own separate, effectively its own P&L and its own business, where we have some franchise leagues where teams have bought in, they're connected to traditional sports, and that's where we focus on bringing in, you know, distribution deals, sponsorship rights, licensing rights, all the rest of that to build up that pie. And they all operate as Riot holistically, but we kind of look at the games and what's happening on the game side as sort of one division of the business, because it's affecting just regular players. And then you have the competitive ecosystem, which is where we start to bring in additional data and insights. We do it on both sides in terms of what we are, but you know, we want to make sure that on the competitive side, you've got that kind of, you know, as its own business model.
That bit, that second bit that you say, you know, the competitive, the league side, that's the bit that resembles the traditional sports world, you know, more precisely. And you can sort of see that the part of this conversation is, one of the questions is, well, I'm a sponsor, okay, or you know, I am a media owner, I want to get into this world, I've been sold the story of esports, I know the top line, I know the audience is where I'm supposed to be, I get all the arguments, and then what happens is the question. And I guess this is from Nielsen Matt's perspective. Mm-hmm. There is a question here in terms of where are we in that journey? Because in sport, that's took a long time and is taking a long time to filter through. So give us a picture of it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, that's where we kind of operate, right? You know, Nielsen at the end of the day is a measurement company. We obviously kind of, our metrics underpin a lot of the broader advertising space. We do a lot of work on the traditional sports side as it relates to sponsorship. And so, you know, we're taking some of those solutions and have really started to kind of transfer that over to the esports world. And I think aim to try to be a source of truth in the esports and kind of gaming space the same way we are for the broader advertising industry, the same way we are in the traditional sports world and all of the sponsorship dollars that swirl around there. So that said, I think, you know, we are still building that, right? And that's what I was kind of alluding to a little bit in the introduction. There's still a lot of conversation going on between, you know, us, the Riots of the world, other kind of big stakeholders in the industry on, you know, how do we kind of standardize those metrics? Because there are still a lot of, you know, phony numbers, I think, kind of floating around the space and a lot of mistruths and things that get communicated. And so I think we're still in kind of a process of kind of unifying that and kind of centering the conversation. There is still a lot of education that has to take place, right? And that a lot of that education has to be directed at, you know, sponsors and, you know, non-endemic brands that are looking to enter the space, because, you know, frankly, there are still learnings to be had and, you know, call it maybe skepticism, I think, that we encounter from brands that maybe have a heavy presence in sports.
I want to know, I'm a sponsor in sport, in traditional sport, I've got a whole load of choices about where to spend the money. And that would normally be, right, I go, okay, should I sponsor the league? Should I sponsor a team? Or should I sponsor a broadcast, the media ecosystem around the product? And I could also pick off a couple of the superstar players and do that. Is that framework, is that pretty much the same? Does that replicate straight across to esports world?
I would say that there's some cross-functionality of that, but it is a little bit different. And I say that it's a little bit different because with some of the larger publishers, the Riots of the world, the Activision Blizzards, the Epics, we're also the distribution and the production arm. So the difference here being that, you know, the Premier League is not actually running the broadcast, right? That is all being run through whatever channel that happens to be. So there's a little bit of a difference here, because when you end up working with the league or with a publisher, you effectively can get embedded into that stream effectively as live content. And that content carries through regardless of the distribution platform. But the way that, you know, to kind of back that up a little bit, yes, there is publisher direct, there is league. League means that you are directly integrated into broadcast, kind of carries through, it lives on VODs and perpetuity and cutdowns and everything else. There is the team aspect where you can go partner with a team. You know, that team, you can get branding on jerseys, you can get other things along those lines. And some leagues have team naming rights that are open. And then you can do a lot of content with those players behind the scenes. The agent landscape with players in particular, I think, is still a little nascent. It is growing very quickly. Agents are starting to realize that there is a sport and these professional athletes are getting paid, you know, $500,000 or more. You know, so there is a lot that's going on there. But it's still right now a lot of times controlled by team versus, you know, saying just going and picking a player and following that player. It really depends on the celebrity of that player until they're retired, until they become a streamer. Then the other angle that you mentioned is you can still do stuff in distribution. That ends up being more kind of, you know, unlike the Twitches or the YouTubes or the Trovos of the world, where you can do more traditional ad buys, right? Or I want exposure. I want, you know, commercial spots to run. I want things like that. It depends on the sport and the title as to whether or not you can actually get integrated into the feed. And that's where the publisher stance comes in, where I can integrate someone directly into that feed. That feed carries across. If I'm on ESPN, if I'm on Sky, if I'm on BBC, which never happens, BBC. But regardless of where we're going, that would carry through because I control the feed and I push it out.
So you are Riot and the publishers are effectively, you are sort of ESPN and the NBA.
Correct. We are the NBA. We are ESPN. And in some cases, you know, because we actually go and rent venues to put on like larger things, we carry people through to all that experiential stuff as well. So yeah, we're kind of a one-stop shop. If you want to go there.
I was going to say it.
The other approach is, yeah, I was trying to hold back.
It's irresistible.
we are kind of that one-stop shop where we can do that. And because we are the publisher and the rights holder of the game, whereas like the NBA or Premier League does not own soccer, right? You know, there's additional tangibilities that can come with working with the publisher direct.
So, and this is a question for Nielsen, Matt. Just on that, the one-stop shop question. Mm-hmm. Just give us an idea then of the breakdown of where people are spending. Is it mainly congregated around leagues and publishers, or is it a bit more spread out?
That's a good question. Yeah, I mean, I think to Matt's point, at least, you know, what we've observed, and obviously there are a few examples now of this changing, I do think some of the bigger, call it more integrated partnerships, have probably been at the league and publisher level. Just again, given what we were just hearing in terms of what you're able to achieve and kind of, you know, multiple touch points or sort of ownership over certain aspects of the broadcast or content, right? So an NFL game, you know, the in-game exposures and sponsors are completely different from maybe the halftime show and some of the other shoulder content, right? Because it's different people and different distributors, different entities that own each of those chunks. And so you have to go to, you know, 3-4 different parties if you want to string together sort of an integrated strategy around that full sort of broadcast and viewing experience, right? Whereas on the esports side, and particularly with the publishers and leagues, you know, they are kind of the ones that are able to kind of manage that sort of unified, call it campaign or activation, throughout those different elements. But again, I think, you know, that's changing a little bit. We've seen some of the, you know, naming rights deals around teams, right? You know, the TSM FTX partnership is one that really kind of, I think, I'm not going to say shook the landscape, but was a pretty landmark deal when you look at the size of the dollar spend there, right? Which puts the naming rights of TSM, for instance, on par with naming rights deals for, you know, MetLife Stadium and some of the bigger, like, you know, iconic sporting venues that we think about. So,
and just for people who are not familiar with that, who are listening, what sort of numbers are we talking about there?
Well, the reported number, and I think it's fairly accurate, but the reported number for that deal was in the ballpark of $210 to $220 million over 10 years. So you're talking $20 to $22 million per year, which again, I believe is what, you know, the MetLifes of the world are paying on an annual basis for naming rights to a massive venue in the New York market. So pretty big numbers. That is kind of I'd say one of the first of its kind, but I think does start to change the conversation in terms of the dollar spend and the size of some of these deals and what a team organization, for instance, is able to achieve. And, you know, I do think you now have a lot of the team organizations behaving more like broader media entities. And some of them have, you know, you think of the FaZe Clans of the world, those guys they've owned that kind of position and have positioned themselves as such kind of in the marketplace like that, I think for a while now. But, you know, when you think of a team like TSM, like Liquid, like, you know, Dignitas, like FaZe, right? These guys, you know, Luminosity, for instance, and the guys in Enthusiast Gaming, These are teams, yes, and they have rosters that compete in competitions and titles and whatnot, but they also have, you know, usually sizable rosters of content creators and streamers who are not necessarily competing. They are just putting out content that supports the team or adds, you know, additional elements to the competitive aspect, and, you know, really starts to, you know, become about sort of growing that particular team's audience as much as they can, so it can be monetized.
I would also, just to jump in on that a little bit too, off of what Nielsen Matt was saying, I think there's multiple ways that you can approach the landscape, right? To what Matt was saying, you know, on the team front, there are teams that are positioned as content houses, right? Mm-hmm. The 100 Thieves, the FaZe Clans of the world, like that's what they're exceptional at doing. But there's also elements where if a brand is looking to target this younger 18-34 audience, they have a specific campaign, maybe for a promotion that's during a summer or a short period of time, where traditionally you would just see billions of commercials blasted, right? Like all across, you know, sports channels or whatever that genre needs to be. Now you can actually go do a similar execution, but you can do that with, you know, the Twitches and the YouTubes of the world, right? Where you can start to build around that or start to build around content creators and streamers and kind of build that. And it's a quick run kind of like entry point. Then there's other things where you go a little deeper, and that's where teams, most teams are looking again for like multi-year relationships to start to build up the fandom. You know, from the league perspective and publisher standpoint, similar for us, we're looking for longer term solutions, right? We're looking for brands that are going to come in, put their foot in the ground, stake in the ground, and build with us over years. You know, that's why we look at 3 to 5 year to 7 year deals with our partners, is to try and build that connectivity with the community. Cause we don't want, you know, you don't want to have a partner of a league come in for like a week and be like, oh, that was fun, disappear. Creates a weird, kind of a weird scenario. Whereas you run a bunch of commercial spots, yeah, you can disappear next week, but there's different mediums for that.
Yep, definitely.
When you look at something like a team deal at that level and that price, what sort of ROI model are they putting on that? Because you say the price point does bring in a whole range of different options, obviously, they've got. And this is about audience, presumably. I'm second guessing their objective, but I'm assuming that this is about the demographic and the audience behavior. But beyond that, how do they go about looking at a return from that sort of investment?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I can't speak necessarily to the ins and outs of that particular deal, but you know, when you think about, you know, esports in particular and a team organization like that, the live stream is you know, similar to kind of linear on the traditional sports side, the live stream is still a main driver of value, and integration into kind of streaming elements and competitions is going to be a main driver of the value that a partnership is generating. So in that case, with TSM, for instance, they've kind of taken over the name of the team. So anytime, anywhere, in theory, that TSM is being referred to, obviously we're still right here and now. I'm only saying TSM, but I think the point is that the team will be known as TSM FTX. And so anytime the team is talked about, anytime you see it represented, you know, in a live stream graphically or talked about, you know, the brand name is going to be mentioned right alongside of that. And I think that's going to be a big piece of the value. So you have the live stream piece, at least in the analyses that we run out, where we do holistic valuations, PR, and just kind of the sort of news cycle and news discussion around an organization is also a massive value driver. And so that's a big piece of the value prop with naming rights, is that anytime, right, a facility is talked about, the brand is talked about, whether that's in written articles, whether that's the, you know, verbal mentions, you know, of the casters during a game. And so I think the same theory probably applies here, and with probably, and again, I have no idea how, and I don't, you know, I don't pretend to know how TSM pitched it or closed the deal, but I imagine that a big piece of the value prop was, you know, the fact that, hey, we are now going to be known as this. And anytime we get talked about, you get talked about. And you think about that over a 10-year period, you actually have what is a pretty powerful proposition, I think.
So it's essentially, it's a media return that they're looking at.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, yeah, see, I kind of slipped into how we often think about things, right? So when we're doing a lot of our analyses, and Matt knows this, a lot of what we're talking about is media return. Obviously, there are other benefits there, right? But, you know, more qualitative kind of brand lift things, right? We do test some of that stuff. But when we're doing valuations, we're usually looking at the media valuation. So yeah, that's why my comments that were probably a little biased towards the media value calculation.
I think you could probably also add in there in what I know about the deal that I can publicly share. There's a lot of content that's also being created, right? So there's a lot of the social exposure. There's a lot of that. So of course there's brand affinity, there's brand awareness, there's the brand bump that you're going to get. But then beyond that, you can start to create, you know, specific moments or activations, or start to drive towards whatever incentive you want by having someone, a Lost or a Sword Art or a Speak on TSM, you know, doing something, or their Valorant teams, or however they're doing what they're doing, like creating some sort of, hey, you get a chance to play with me. Oh, that's amazing. Like, I get a chance to play with Harry Kane. That's super cool. Like, what do I need to do? I will sign up for anything. Just give me that chance to be on the pitch. And so you can do that virtually by playing literally anywhere with anyone. So
yep.
I think there's a lot of value that you can see there that will manifest over time.
And and I think we've talked about the transactional components as it relates to kind of esports and games. I'm kind of speculating now, and Matt may have more intimate knowledge of kind of the some of the details there. But I would imagine that there's maybe some sort of transactional kind of tie-in with FTX being obviously a crypto exchange, and you know, crypto being a growing means of transacting. Matt spoke earlier about the partnership with MasterCard and how kind of purchasing and transactions were kind of looped into some of that partnership. There've been a few other of these kind of naming rights deals with other fintech brands and transactions being a part of that. So would be curious to see how they loop that kind of element in and kind of actual usage of the FTX platform as it relates to trading crypto, or maybe some other kind of transactions that they're working on together. But I wouldn't be surprised if that also came into play over the life of this deal.
With any naming rights deal, there is the policing of the media, making sure that they use the term, but it's the question is whether or not it migrates into just into the language of the players and the fans and the viewers. And if Stadia is the case study, it tends to be, that's quite hard miles. If you're working for a PR company who is just policing that, it's a pretty hard slog. But if it's a new team, then happy days, because nothing else to call it. And that tends to pick up much, much easier, obviously. Is there a market for brands coming in and saying, no, we just want to set up our own thing here because we don't want to risk looking like we're intruding or buying up real estate, but we're going to create something of our own?
Good question. And when you say creating something of their own, how do you mean exactly?
Well, I guess it's the line between, here's a team that we're going to create. The three of us are going to spend 10 million quid creating a team, or 100 million quid creating a team. We're going to call it Unofficial Partner, or we're going to call it MasterCard Unofficial Partner, and away we go. I'm wondering if that is an approach, given if this is the price tag of coming in and badging something. I'd be wondering what the cost of going all in is.
Yeah, so I can speak to that just kind of at one level, and then maybe turn it back over to the other Matt. But it really depends on the sport and the ecosystem. So for instance, within League of Legends, we are franchised. So like, even if we were to collectively say, we're going to build something, you start to hire the coaches and the trainers and the sports psychologists, you got to bring all the players in and have a training facility and get all that going, which does not cost $100 a year, right? It's definitely in the seven figures to make sure all that's being done. Then you have to figure out, okay, well, what sport am I actually competing in? Because they're going to be focused solely on that one particular sport or title. And then that league might be franchised and might not have any open slots, in which case you can't compete at the professional level. So you have to compete at an amateur level or something like that. And prize pools might not be there or might not be set up that way. So there's a lot of that that needs to come into it. I think what you've seen is team organizations, whether they're the portfolio orgs, like, you know, the Cloud9s, the TSMs that operate in multiple sports, you know, enthusiasts, et cetera, and be like NRG, they have multiple sports where you can do that. And if you're a brand, you can still come in and you can have a conversation. I think part of it is also, how does that brand want to get it? I know there was some news not long ago, I think Shopify in Canada, I don't know if it's a CEO or someone on the executive team was a huge Dota fan. And like, they love playing Dota, which is a different MOBA. And they actually built their own team because that ecosystem is a little bit more open. And they called it like the Shopify whatever team. So they kind of took that approach of, we're going to go in, we're going to kind of buy out people's contracts and start all over again without knowing all the financials. But I feel like at least right now, it seems like the more sustainable approach would be a brand partner identifying what values a team has that facilitates and aligns with you. MasterCard might look at a team like TSM and say, they are exactly who we want. Or they might look at a team like Cloud9 and go, man, this is perfect for me, right? Like, this is what I want to do. Let's go in. And so I think that's where those brand values can be, so that the team can continue to operate and be free to do what it needs to do and use the partner to help support. Similarly, the partner can say, you know, MasterCard front, I need a priceless moment. Give me all of your team or give me your owner, and then we can get your owner to talk to someone. And then that kind of solves two pieces of it. You know, the market and esports, it is fragmented because there's a lot of titles, there's a lot of things out there, there's different regions. But I would, knowing what I know, I would say it probably makes the most sense to identify something that's there and then help grow it or build it versus just like starting all over from zero. If you're a brand, if you're, this is what we know and we do it and we were a team or we were a player. Yep, there you go. You've got that intimate knowledge of like how that all needs to work.
There's interesting you say that. I was talking to Ralph Reichart on the podcast, who was one of the co-founders of the ESL. And I was asking him about the mistakes that traditional sports teams make when they get into esports. And you can see that, you know, the journey of there is a meeting somewhere at Old Trafford and they say, well, we need a Man United esports team. And they then, and this is generic, not to specifically on United, but there is an underestimation of the cost, but also they forget they need to win and they forget the performance side of esports. So they go in and say, right, okay, we're Spurs, we're Man United, we're Juventus, whoever it is. And then they end up with a team that isn't winning or isn't, they haven't done the homework or there is something wrong on the performance side. And then they think, well, actually, this isn't our brand. And so the brand stretch from the club to the esports division, it feels like a different entity. And what you're saying there is the same sort of argument, but pointing it towards the brand content, brand ownership side.
Yeah, I mean, that same kind of cross parallel makes sense though, because, you know, there is the, sure, you can build the fit and we've built it and here it is. And this team on paper is going to just dominate and they get out there and they don't and they go 0-for or whatever. And suddenly you are sitting back going, well, my brand doesn't lose. Mm-hmm. So what are we going to do here? Do we just fire everyone and start over? Is it the coach's fault? Is it this? Is it that? And then it could just be a really weird like turntable of, you know, it's a different team every split. It's a different team every quarter, every year. And there's no family community there. That's where I think some teams have started to, and some teams are doing it really well. And we were talking as well about kind of the content engines. It's like you're creating a brand in and of yourself that can live regardless of whether your team performs. You could have a really bad year and maybe you thought your best player, they're just not feeling it. They're just off. They're not there. They get sick and you're like, you know what? We're going to chalk this one up. It sucks, but we're going to look towards the future. But guess what? We're going to do all this other stuff. And that still delivers value. And that kind of hits on those brand collaboration, brand value, brand morals that you're trying to drive. And then you come out of it very happy. Yep. But yeah, I think a lot of team owners will say, well, here's what we've done in football. Here's what we've done in basketball or baseball. This is great. I have a big checkbook. I'm just going to go buy this thing. And then they check in 3 months and say, well, where's my return? And it's like, well, when you bought the soccer club in the first place, you didn't expect, technically you probably did, but hopefully didn't expect a return and an out clause in like 2 weeks after signing the deal, right? You got to like build that equity over time. The same thing needs to happen here where you get in, you start to build, you start to learn things and, you know, you got to bring that puzzle together.
Yep.
Who's spending money? Which categories? Where would you put your money on a growth category over the next sort of 18 months to 2 years?
Obviously, there have been some big splashes. You know, one particular brand, which Matt, I think this is the deal you were alluding to.
let's talk about that. Matt, what is that one?
So we actually just signed FTX as our cryptocurrency exchange partner for the LCS, and it's a 7-year commitment. So we are jumping in. They're going to show up and broadcast starting this Saturday, which is our postseason. So we're actually going to be working with them. There's some storytelling around the most improved player that they're going to be able to kind of help build and nurture throughout the year. And then on top of that, we actually built a customized package where they get to, you know, as we like to say, kind of quote unquote, own gold. So like there's going to be the FTX gold advantage. And so there's actually a new metric that we're putting on screen where you've always had gold, which is kind of like how teams are performing. It's basically like how well they're doing within League of Legends. You start with zero. The more gold you have, the more abilities, the more things you can buy to make you stronger and bigger, right? But we've never had like an advantage. It's always just been like, you have to look at it and do math. And they're like, well, you know, people don't always like to do math sometimes on a Saturday or a Sunday. So now it's going to be there. But we're really excited about it. And I think I would also just take a step back. This was also where data informed it. We did a lot of deep diving with, you know, stuff from Nielsen as well as some other parties to see, is this something our community wants? Are they excited about it? Is there education that can happen? Is this the right move for us? And, you know, from a Riot standpoint, we did a lot of due diligence just on the category, on the ecosystem. What is it? What's regulated? What's not regulated? And that's where we then selected a few partners, had discussions, and very excited that we've got FTX and got to out to play League as well. So that makes the conversation even more fun.
Yeah.
7 years, is that normal? That sounds exceptionally long.
It is one of our longer deals. Generally, we will, like, our whole mantra is like longer, deeper relationships. So we like to do 3 to 5 year deals or 3 to 4 year deals, depending on what it is. You know, I think as Matt was alluding, just coming in for 3 months and running away is not, that doesn't really add anything to our fan base. Like they're not used to that behaviorally. Like they need the story to be there. But this is something that we felt really strongly about, was getting in, committing to it and building. If we're going to make this change to our broadcast, we want it to be something that's there, particularly with an award. Like Honda owns our MVP and they've been our partner for 3.5 years now. So, you know, like those are the things that we want to make sure are consistent.
Okay.
Yeah. And so I mean, the crypto, you know, phenomenon is really interesting. So that one was top of mind. And if you think about crypto, Matt talked about microtransactions and that being kind of, a major revenue driver and a core part of Riot's overall business strategy. At least on the surface of it, there's a very like easy link between crypto, microtransactions, the type of transactions that happen in esports and games. That's cognitively, I think that's a very easy link for fans to make to a brand like FTX in the crypto space. So,
I mean, that is a definition of endemic adjacent.
Yeah, for sure.
It's catchy.
Yeah. We can push this. We can push this thing. I know we've initiated, just in some of our syndicated studies, I've actually just in conjunction with some of our other leadership team, we've initiated quite a bit of research just on the crypto space, and we'll be able to kind of cut that by esports fans and kind of look a little bit deeper into that and start to kind of unravel this a little bit more. But again, cognitively, I think there's a very clear connection there between crypto and kind of the esports and games world. I mean, if you think about other brands that are, you know, or categories that are leading the charge, you know, Matt mentioned insurance. We've seen, you know, State Farm, Geico, those types of brands have really leaned into the esports world, really in the same way that they do in the traditional sports world. I think snacks and kind of beverage brands continue to be very comfortable with the space. There's a cultural fit there. They, you know, those snacking and eating occasions tend to coincide with watching and playing occasions. So that's kind of one and the same consumer. So we've seen a lot of investment there.
What's happening with the insurance? Why is insurance spiking? Is that, what's the story there? I'm just trying to work out, is it just a demographic targeting issue?
Yeah. I mean, you think about 18 to 34 year olds. Those are often, you know, folks that are, you know, coming out of college, buying their first car, renting an apartment, needing, you know, renter's insurance, right? You're starting to kind of enter the world and start to really, you're at a point in your life where you're tuning into the insurance space and sort of needing that coverage and protection just in your, you know, where you are in your kind of economic development and sort of what you're starting to kind of purchase. And some of those big life purchases, you know, you often need insurance to protect those. So, so I think there's an interesting story to be told there. So yeah, I mean, those are the ones we're kind of, you know, those are the big ones I think we're kind of looking at and also see naturally kind of surfacing in our data. It'll be interesting to see if sort of the fintech space and some of the movement we've seen with crypto starts to inspire more traditional banking brands. I personally think a lot of the established banks have been slow to move on the esports world and have probably missed out on a pretty big opportunity, just given exactly what we're talking about, how many transactions actually happen around esports and gaming. So that'll be an interesting one to kind of keep an eye on. But, you know, the auto space, right? Auto brands have been pretty comfortable and quick to move on esports. So yeah, I think we're seeing a shift where, you know, we're going to start to see, I think, a flood of investment from across lots and lots of different categories at this point.
Okay, I've got one question. It's about the media ecosystem around esports. And again, if you start with looking at the sports world, the media rights income is the number one item on the balance sheet. I guess I'm interested in what the relationship between the Twitches of this world and, you know, the sort of Facebooks and the tech platforms, and who's paying who, how does that work, and what's the difference between them?
Matt probably knows more about this given, you know, his company owns some leagues and operates some leagues. But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, you're starting to see a similar type of situation where you have these exclusive deals, right? I mean, this happened with, you know, Overwatch and Call of Duty League, right? Where initially we're being broadcast on Twitch, and then suddenly YouTube kind of came in and paid for the exclusive rights to kind of broadcast that content. Now that's kind of the setup. So you're starting to see, I think, that same model, at least as far as, you know, leagues potentially selling exclusive broadcast rights. I think the commercial structure underneath that is still maybe a little bit different, right? So, you know, you think about an NBA or the NFL, right? Those, I mean, even EPL, right? In Champions League, there's media exclusivity, but, you know, the money that's generated from selling that exclusivity often will trickle back down to the teams. I don't know if that's necessarily, I know in certain cases that's not the case. So I think some of that commercial structure is still kind of evolving, and I think the space is still kind of figuring that out. But definitely see the YouTubes and the Twitches of the world moving and behaving like some of the bigger, more traditional, for lack of a better word, media operations, right? Even, you know, not even as it relates to just esports, right? I mean, you know, Twitch and Amazon are out buying up all kinds of sports media rights, esports and traditional sports. So not a huge difference necessarily from kind of my perspective. But again, I'm not front and center in having those conversations. I don't know if Matt feels any differently, but certainly see some of that similar behavior kind of making its way to esports and gaming content from my perspective.
Yeah, I would just add on to that. I mean, I think the model is catching up, right? Mm-hmm. Like right now, if you look at the pie of like where investment is coming from, kind of the sponsor partner side is still a larger piece of that pie, which, you know, if you look at the other traditional leagues, it's pretty much all in the media rights, and the league sits back and goes, we're good. We got $1 billion, got it signed, sealed, money goes out to teams, everyone's happy. But I think a lot of that comes down to the key word here is exclusivity, right? Mm. So if you are a Premier League, if you are the NFL, you are Major League Baseball, you had these broadcasters coming to you pitching exclusivity of, Sunday night games are only on my channel. Thursday night is here. Saturday is here, right? The way that esports has been in Riot's position in particular has been non-exclusive. So we are everywhere, right? So in terms of that, you're effectively creating a scenario where everyone has the same access point, and it comes down to the viewing platform, right? And I think the other difference here is that if we were the league saying, hey, we have the rights, you as a distribution channel can go actually run your own broadcast, that changes the conversation. But we're actually producing our own broadcast, and that's where the Activision Blizzards are as well. So in many ways, esports, like, we kind of have the cards. We could just say we are going to distribute it or not, and it comes down to the exclusivity approach of where do you want to go and not. And like ESL will do things differently than Riot will do, and Valve will do things very differently than Epic, and everyone's kind of got a different philosophical approach to it. But I think the days of will the distribution rights start to grow? Absolutely. And I think that's going to come down to behaviors and how things really get manifested, and or just creating that mindset of, on this day, I go to this channel to watch, right? Like in the US, right? If you want NFC games or AFC games for the NFL, you know you're going to this channel or this channel. It's just habitual at this point, right? 10 years ago, maybe not. You're like, oh my God, where do I go? And then boom, I get it. It's there. Tune in messaging comes around. So I think that's kind of where the difference has been. It's still catching up, but I think it's growing very quickly.
And the experience is, in terms of from the fan's perspective or the user's perspective, is do they care where it is?
I think that's the other interesting thing is that as right now, the core audience that's grown up watching gaming, I'll just call it gaming in general, has been on streaming platforms. So it's Twitch and it's YouTube or Facebook Gaming and some of the others that have tried and kind of fallen off, right? But it's probably no doubt to say that Twitch kind of owns the majority of that. And that's where people just know to go. And there's functions that Twitch has when you're watching a streamer or you're watching Riot's programming or whatever that you get it, you know, you get used to and you get excited about. YouTube has a different, you know, kind of approach. They have chat, but there's different functionalities there. There are fans that we know that love and only will go to YouTube. There are some that we know that will only go to Twitch, right? And then we can sit back and we can see the percentages. Whereas 2-3 years ago, it was like 80 to 85% Twitch. That number has gotten closer to 50-50 between Twitch and YouTube, and then some others coming into play. So I think you're just seeing behavior, seeing new people come in, you're seeing different exposure points and different executions. And all of it comes down to like what the publisher, the rights holder will do and allow, and then where things are exclusive or not.
Okay. Well, listen, we have come to the end, and I really appreciate it. As we said at the beginning, it's a very broad sweep across what is a really fascinating area. And so thanks for your time. I really appreciate it. And we're going to use the rest of the eSport Economics series with Nielsen to cover and go into some of those rabbit holes that we started to crawl down today. But until then, Matt Archambault, is that right? I've got that. Archambault. My French. I should say that I failed French CSE.
You're his first fan. It's okay.
You can do no wrong. Now, I better not mispronounce it. So.
Yeah. Yes. But anyway, thank you, Matt. And Matt Boyd from Nielsen, thanks very much for your time. Cheers, guys.
Thanks a lot. A lot of fun.
Absolutely. Cheers.